During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Back to school savings are officially in session at Tanger Outlets. Shop tax-free August 4th through 5th and save up to 70% off the latest school styles, the best of apparel, footwear, accessories, and more. Save at Nike Factory Store, American Eagle, Gap Outlet, Crocs, Under Armour, Banana Republic Factory, and hundreds more. There's always something happening. Discover the latest fun and events all season long. Tanger Outlets, your savings destination.
Dress, the history of fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, in 1954, Christian Dior wrote in his book, talking about fashion, quote, "Fashion comes from a dream, and the dream is an escape from reality." And as we all know, it's when we sleep that we dream, which is perhaps why the Metropolitan Museum of Art's current exhibition, Sleeping Beauty's Reawakening Fashion, is one of the dreamiest fashion exhibitions I have ever seen.
The exhibition is comprised of more than 220 objects, which are visually connected to one another by their use of themes of nature. And the show's premise seeks to, quote, bring to life objects from the Met collection by reactivating their sensory qualities and engaging visitors' sensorial perceptions through primary research, conservation analysis, and diverse technologies, end quote. All of which we are going to learn more about in detail this week in a two-part episode with members of the Costume Institute's curatorial collections and conservation teams. This is so exciting. Who all came together to execute the exhibition's novel premise, which often highlights the garment's deterioration, quote, as a metaphor for the transience of fashion.
We are so pleased to have Andrew Bolton, curator in charge of the Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, join us today for the very first time on Dressed to share his thoughts on the exhibition's, quote, aims to reconnect the works on display as they were originally intended, with vibrancy, with dynamism, and ultimately with life, end quote. And along the way, we just might hear about some of the Costume Institute's spectacular masterworks, which have never or rarely ever been seen before. So this exhibition really truly is, Cass, a fashion historian's dream come to life.
Andrew, we are so thrilled to have you here with us today. Thank you so, so much for joining us. This is really a treat for both of us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yes, a very enthusiastic welcome to Dressed. We are delighted and have been wanting to have you on the show for quite some time, it must be said.
Yes, and what better way to welcome you to the show than with this incredible exhibition we are here to talk about today. But first, we actually wanted to start by posing a question that we love to pose to our guests. And that is about your earliest memory of fashion or the act and power of dressing. And then we're hoping if you would share that and then also maybe a little bit about your background and the professional path that led you to the Costume Institute.
Sure. Good question. I suppose my earliest memory in terms of fashion rather than just clothing in general was I grew up in a very small village in the north of England in Lancashire. And my only outlet really for eye fashion was the Blitz magazine. I was coming of age at a moment where all the style magazines were coming to the surface, like Face, like Blitz, Arena, and ID. And I think my earliest memory is just looking at the Blitz kids in the late 80s, actually early 80s, and people like John Galliano and Stephen Jones and Trojan and Lee Bowery. And I was just amazed about their bravery and how they would look to history for these inspirations. But it was mainly just that they would use fashion in a way that I think one should use it, which is to provoke and to confront and to focus on ideas of identity and using clothing to express quite complex ideas about identity, gender and sexuality or race and even like nationhood. So I think that was probably my earliest memories. And I've never really outgrown it. I love historicism. I love designers who look to history for inspiration and build their works around historicism. So yeah, I think that's probably my earliest memory of fashion. And I suppose it was more street style than hype fashion. It was really how these club kids would put their flea market finds together in very specific ways and to express these remarkable ideas about identity. So yeah, I think that was probably my earliest memory.
And then how did you translate that into a career? I was actually surprised when I started learning about you, but I guess not surprised because I am familiar with your work, that you studied to be an anthropologist.
Yeah, when I was at school, we were visited in my sixth form when I was doing my A-levels by two anthropologists. And it was extraordinary. And they were focusing on dress as well, the differences and the comparables of dress and the similarities of dress. And I just found their work so compelling. I suppose I didn't really think I went to university in the mid 80s that studying fashion was really an option.
Right. I think we've all been there.
Particularly for like an academic discipline. You know, I had friends who I was at school with who went to do their foundation course and went to design colleges, but I really wanted to be an academic and I wanted to follow an academic path, but I didn't think that fashion was really an option for me. I did anthropology at University of East Anglia, which had a really good anthropology school. And also I did a minor in art history. And when I left university, I sort of bummed around for a couple of years and worked for the French anthropologist who inspired me to go to study anthropology at university. I actually worked with him in Chiang Mai University for a couple of months. And then I came back and did my postgrad. And yeah, again, I ended up in museums mainly because I didn't get funding for my PhD. I was doing a PhD on applying classical rhetoric to Indonesian architecture. And probably because of that reason, I didn't get funding. And I applied for a job at the V&A and got a position as a curatorial assistant. And at that time, it was a wonderful opportunity. It was a program where you would float from department to department. And again, because of my background, I ended up in the East Asian department and very gradually twisted people's arms to get me into the dress and fashions department. But again, very circuitous. So I started off as an anthropologist and ended up in fashion in a very circuitous way. But I always loved it and I always wanted to end up there. I just didn't know how to do it.
And this is actually precisely one of the reasons why we ask people who are fashion historians now, professional fashion historians, how they ended up in our field, because everybody has these different paths. And so, you know, we have a lot of young people that listen to the show that reach out to us and they're like, I'm interested in being a fashion historian, but I don't have blah, 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 blah. And we always say there's a million different ways to get here.
Yeah. And I also think it's super fascinating always to consider when fashion wasn't taken seriously as a form of scholarship and academic study, because what we're about to talk about today, things have so clearly changed. But Valerie Steele obviously famously wrote about how fashion used to be the F word in academia, right? Because she was basically laughed at when she wanted to study the cultural history of corsetry. So we've come a long way.
Yeah, yes. And that's what I always love about the field that we're in, particularly, you know, fashion within museums, because of the centrality of fashion to our lives and to our contemporary lives. And I know that Harold, my predecessor, would always tell the same anecdote, but when you see visitors in our galleries, it's so much more lively and people have an opinion and it's subjective and they're not afraid to voice their opinion, as opposed to going into perhaps a European paintings gallery. And there's this immediacy and an accessibility to fashion that allows people to be more brave in their opinions.
And this is precisely what I experienced. I've seen the show twice now. And people were chattering, right? There's conversations happening and debates happening. I like this. I don't like this. What do you think about this? So congratulations on the show, which has been open for a little over a month now. And hopefully you have gotten some R&R and your whole team, or hopefully you will soon, because this is an incredibly ambitious show that's up right now. When I was reading the exhibition catalog, I realized that I have missed more than a few things, so I will be returning for a third time. But I guess missing some things is to be expected given there are 220-some objects in the show. Andrew, would you give us an outline of the premise of the exhibition and also maybe what inspired this particular topic in the first place?
Well, I suppose in a nutshell, the exhibition Sleeping Beauties, the title, it endeavors to resuscitate or reawaken garments from our permanent collection by reactivating their sensory qualities and also re-engaging our sensorial perceptions. And I think that maybe it's not known to the general public, but when an item of clothing enters the costume institute's collection or any costume collection, you know, its status, it really is changed irrevocably. Fashion, what was really once a vital part of our lived experience, it becomes like a work of art, a sort of lifeless work of art. And all of the senses that usually are imbued within clothing, whether it's about the idea of hearing it or touching it or even smelling it, are all denied visitors. So the only sense you're left with really is the sense of sight, which is actually enhanced in a museum context because it allows you to focus more on the construction and the technique. But all the other senses that are so integral to the full appreciation and understanding of fashion are denied. So in a way, the show came out of a frustration to sort of reinvigorate garments within our collection through the senses. And so, yeah, I think that's probably where the inspiration came from.
And the exhibition's title refers to a selection of very specific sleeping beauties, too fragile to mount on mannequins because they suffer from individual cases of inherent vice. So I was hoping you could define inherent vice for those of our listeners who might not know, especially in the context of costume collections. And are there a few specific examples of sleeping beauties which you find especially interesting in this regard?
Sure, yeah. Inherent vice. And it sounds like a movie, doesn't it, from the
80s? It's a thriller for sure.
It's a term that conservators invented or at least formulated. And it refers to a quality that's intrinsic to an artwork that, in a way, it's the very cause of its ruin. So in a way, it's a form of built-in destruction, so self-destruction. And then in fashion, I suppose sometimes it's built into the actual materiality. Sometimes it's the way it's finished. Sometimes it's the construction of the garment. Sometimes it's the ornamentation. So inherent vice can emanate from those different types of aspects of fashion. And I suppose a good example is probably the one we open with, which is one of the garments that inspired the exhibition. And it's a ball gown by Charles Frederick Worth that dates to 1887, made of silk satin. And the satin itself has suffered really catastrophic loss of its very ultra-fine vertical threads, its warp threads. We call it warp loss. And so it's resulted in these very large swathes of areas where only the more sturdier horizontal threads remain or the weft threads remain. And there's actually no current conservation treatment that can really fully stabilize the satin. So that's one example of inherent vice. And another one is another Worth dress, actually from Jean-Philippe Worth, which is an evening dress from 1902. And it's a warp-printed silk taffeta, basically. And the small splits that pervade the entire dress, the entire silk, and it's become so weak and so brittle that it fractures when it's actually flexed. And in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, silk, and taffeta in particular, was often treated with bath and metallic salts, really to impart a sort of stiffness and also to add a glossiness and also to enhance the scroop, which is, I'm sure we'll talk to in a minute, which is the characteristic rustling sound of taffeta. And over time, the salts have reacted with the silk and they break it down on both a chemical and a physical level, and so which is resulting in a very fragile condition. So I suppose they're good examples, but it's not just historical materials that also have this inherent vice. We have a garment that was donated by Trina Vicarda, who was Alexander McQueen's right-hand person for many years. And it was a jacket kit that came from his Hunger collection from spring, summer 1996, I think it is. And it's an orange jacket with images of feathers that were actually created by the textile designer Simon Unglis, who was a longtime collaborator of McQueen. And to produce these images, these feathers, he laid the feathers on a nylon silk screen coated with a sort of light sensitive emulsion. And the screen was then exposed to ultraviolet light, which caused the uncovered areas of the emulsion to harden and bind to the screen. So it's also creating these, it limits the flexibility. And over time, it's created these splits in the garment. So even with contemporary materials, inherent vice is very prevalent.
It must be said that the Sleeping Beauties are too delicate to be mounted on mannequins. So they are actually laid flat in these little vitrine cases throughout the exhibition. They're just simply too fragile. They have to lay down flat. And a lot of that probably was put forth by the conservation team, which is actually what I want to ask about next, because they had to have played a massive part in this show particular, because their role in the Costume Institute is actually part of this exhibition's premise. And it really puts their work in the spotlight in many ways that some other exhibitions, their work is intentionally meant to be hidden because things are meant to be perfect. So would you tell our listeners a little bit about how the curatorial team and maybe even the collections and conservation teams work together to make fashion exhibition magic happen?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Because you say quite rightly, usually the work of our collections team and our conservation team and our installation team are invisible because their work is so extraordinary and they're such experts in their field. And as you say, the intention is to make the garments look perfect, to display them perfectly. So often their talents are, you don't see them because they're so brilliant. And the intention is that you don't see this extraordinary work that goes into it. But in this particular case, I really wanted to put a spotlight on their expertise and their talents through focusing on these issues of conservation, but also issues of installation. And even you mentioned the garments lying flat, which seems like such an easy thing to do. Our collection team spent weeks trying to make these garments look so beautiful when laid flat, and they're extraordinary. And I have to say, I've always fought against our conservators who sometimes want to show garments flat because of their fragility. And I said, oh, no, you can't see the silhouette. You can't see how the garment was intended to be displayed. But I really changed my mind after seeing the incredible work that our collections team had put into these garments. They look exquisite. And it also makes you look at them differently as well. It makes you focus a little bit more on the ornamentation, a little bit more on the construction, less on the silhouette, because obviously you need the body to activate that part of it. I know it's a cliche to say it takes a village to put on an exhibition, but it really does. And we have the most remarkable team who are experts in the field. And even like Joyce Fung, who's our installation manager. And I'm always amazed about how she's able to make our garments look so precise in terms of their silhouette. And we made the decision this time round to use what we call ghost mannequins, which are basically mannequins where you can't see their limbs there. And because so you can focus on the garments. But even that involved, Joyce had to dress the garment on a mannequin, cut the mannequin or outline the mannequin where it needs to be cut. Then it gets sent over to someone called Frank Glover, who cuts a mannequin, has to be redressed. So even that process takes a long time. And almost every mannequin we use, Joyce customizes every mannequin to the garment. I call her Frankenstein. She literally has this Frankenstein approach to all the mannequins. But it's what makes, I think, our shows so beautiful because of Joyce's dressing.
And we are going to talk to members of both the collections team and the conservation team later this week after your episode airs. So we're excited to learn more from them, too.
Yeah, there really is just an extraordinary amount of work that goes on behind the scenes of these exhibitions. And I also want to give a shout out to Glenn Peterson, who is a bit of a legend in our field, I will say. And he's really been making the rounds on social media because the Met, you all have been so generous in taking us behind the scenes in these wonderful social media videos and giving insights into that conservation process, which is really, really special.
He's remarkable. I didn't think there's anybody like Glenn. His hand skills, I've never seen a conservator who has those extraordinary hand skills. And I think what makes Glenn so special, as well as being an incredible conservator, he also approaches it from an aesthetic perspective. So it's not just from a scientific and preservation and conservation perspective, which is his priority, and where he comes from. He also has a remarkable eye. So he's able to imbue his conservation and conservation practice with a really refined aesthetic, which makes him incredibly rare.
Absolutely. So because this show is so vast, it goes without saying that it called for an organizational structure, which is by and large the natural world. How does this play out in the thematic organization of the show?
Yeah, good question again, because when I started working on the exhibition, I went through, we have over 35,000 pieces in our collection, and I went through every single one on our database initially before refining it down to pieces I wanted to see. And initially, I was really just focusing on masterworks, actually. Masterworks in our collection that I've always wanted to activate and reanimate through the senses. But when I was working on my storyboard outside my office, it was getting a real bit of a hodgepodge. You know, it was all over the place. Nothing was really tying it together. And we have so many examples in our collection of garments and accessories inspired by the natural environment, the natural world. So that became the thesis for the exhibition. And the galleries really unfold as a series of case studies, as you say, united by the theme of nature. So motifs like flowers and foliage and birds and insects and fish and shells, and that it's organized into three groupings, earth, air, and water. And I think also why I think I wanted to arrive at nature was I felt that in many ways, nature serves as the ultimate metaphor for fashion. You know, it's rebirth, renewal, and cyclicity, but also ideas of transience and ephemerality and evanescence. And those qualities are really evident in the Sleeping Beauties that we just spoke about. So for me, nature became this overarching narrative for the exhibition and the sort of ephemerality and the cyclicity of fashion.
Well, I'm glad you brought up this term masterworks, because one of the things that I really appreciated within the show and within the themes and the historic garments using that theme, oftentimes they're put in conversation with more contemporary pieces in really interesting and sometimes surprising ways. And one of my favorite of these types of pairings is in the tulips section. And we get to see this incredible evening cape from the House of Worth from 1889. And then nearby, we find a Dries Van Noten ensemble from 2014. So more than 125 years actually separate these two garments, and yet they have a shared history. They have a shared story. So would you tell us a little bit about the dialogue between these two particular examples? And then maybe if there are any other similar pairings of garments in conversation with each other that you think are especially poignant.
Yeah, sure. I think part of the idea for the show, another way of reawakening costume star collection was through interpretation or reinterpretation. So the idea of designers who either directly or indirectly were inspired by specific garments in our collection and resurrected them conceptually. And as you said, we've got many examples. I think the one you mentioned is probably my favorite too, which was an extraordinary evening cloak by Worth, Charles Frederick Worth. And it's made from a textile called Tulip Hollandaise, which was displayed at the 1889 Paris Exposition Universelle. And at the time, it was one of the most costly fabrics to have been produced, mainly because of its pattern repeat, which is more than 3 feet long, and it required like 31,000 cars on the Jacquard loom. So it was really complicated. And Dries was inspired directly by this particular piece. And he actually commissioned a reproduction of the textile for his, I think it was his spring, summer 2014 collection. And it featured coats, other garments. We actually have the coat, which has a self-fabric sort of belt tied around the waist, really in a way to try and downplay the textile's preciousness. And he was explaining that when he was working on the collection, he loved how the fabric looked inside out or from the back on the purse. So we have one garment, one coat that has the Tulip Hollandaise pattern as you see it from the front. And he's done the reverse on another piece so it's inside out with the excess of the silk threads are hanging loose. And it's really beautiful. So yeah, and that was for him an accidental find for that particular piece. I think another gallery, and this is a whole gallery devoted to this idea actually, which was we've called it Garthwaite's Garden. And it's actually, the centerpiece is a waistcoat, one of the rarest pieces in our collection that was designed by Anna Maria Garthwaite, who produced a lot of designs for Spitalfields Silks in London. And when she designed this particular, it was a watercolor. She would actually do all of the designs through watercolor and then would get translated into fabric. And she was almost like 60 years old when she created this particular design. And it features poppies and honeysuckles and carnations. And she's known for a very realistic sort of sensibility. That was really what she was known for. And it's that particular waistcoat inspired so many different designers. So we have an example by Vivienne Westwood. That was worn by Kate Moss on the runway. We also have a piece by an ensemble by someone called Felix Chabluk-Smith. And it was from his graduation collection from Royal College of Art. And it's an extraordinary piece. And he's turned Anna Maria Garthwaite's idyllic florals around and where it's become invaded by weeds and spiders. So it's more of a deconstructivist approach. And then we have another example in that gallery by Nicolas Ghesquière, where he was inspired by, not specifically by Anna Maria Garthwaite, but by 18th century French menswear from our collection. So him and his design team came to the Costume Institute, looked at various men's formal clothing from the 18th century and created a series of looks. It has a much more of a French sensibility than Anna Maria Garthwaite's English sensibility, but they all come together around Anna Maria Garthwaite's waistcoats.
I was so excited to see this because I actually had taught a fashion history class where I mentioned that Anna Maria Garthwaite just a few weeks ago. So it was very thrilling to see it up close in person because I had only ever seen photos of it before. So thank you. Dress listeners, with our fashion history tours of Paris coming up, Cass and I have been brushing up on our French with Rosetta Stone. The language learning expert for more than 30 years, Rosetta Stone makes learning a new language quick and easy because you learn by immersion.
There are no English translations, so you really can learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. And their programs are available to use on your desktop or as an app. There's even a speech recognition feature that helps you perfect your pronunciation.
With 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Dutch, Arabic, and Polish at your fingertips, don't put off learning that language any longer. There's no better time than right now to get started.
And for a very limited time, Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today for 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Cass, it seems just about anyone I ask these days has far too much on their plate or are actually going through some pretty major life changes. And sometimes it's pretty amazing to have some extra support from someone else outside of your inner circle. And that's why I turn to my therapist to help talk me through some of life's stressful moments, which is something we all experience.
Therapy isn't only for those who experienced a major trauma. It's a tool to support you in becoming the best version of yourself. And BetterHelp is here to support your journey. BetterHelp's licensed therapists are available to you online with convenient online appointments suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Whether you want to understand interpersonal conflicts or just need a little bit of help focusing, BetterHelp is here for you.
Visit betterhelp.com/dress today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/dressed.
This episode is sponsored by ByHeart. For a wide variety of reasons, not every mother can breastfeed. So we would like to introduce you to ByHeart, the only U.S.-made infant formula with globally sourced ingredients to use organic, grass-fed whole milk.
ByHeart features a patented protein blend that gets closest to breast milk. ByHeart's blend includes the most abundant protein found in breast milk, alpha-lac, as well as lactoferrin, the number one protein found in colostrum.
ByHeart is made with certified clean ingredients, no soy, corn syrup, GMOs, or palm oil. The formula includes prebiotics and an 80-20 whey-to-casein ratio, just like early breast milk, which is tailor-made for the newborn's digestive system.
Curious about ByHeart? Redeem your welcome offer at byheart.com/podcast with code DRESSED for a limited time. Additional terms and conditions apply. That's BYHeart, byheart.com/podcast, and use the code DRESSED. Andrew, in the introduction to the exhibition catalog, you write, quote, "Nature, like fashion, depends on the widest sensory engagements for its fullest sensorial expression." And this really brings us to arguably the most exciting, new, innovative part of this exhibition, which is this immersive and experiential aspect. Can you describe the myriad of ways visitor senses are activated?
Yeah, we wanted the show to be really try to encourage more personal and sort of participatory connections to make it more intimate. So we try to offer a landscape, I suppose, of cross-sensory interplays. So visitors, you can hear the rustling of silk taffeta, the mid-18th century Ribana Française. I mentioned it earlier, it's a specific sound called scroop, which sounds like a garage band, but it's a combination of scroop and scrape and whoop. In French, it's called frou-frou. And you can hear the sound of the scroop of the 18th century Ribana Française. You can also hear the tinkling of aluminum flowers from a dress by Francesco Riso for Marni. And you can also hear like razor clams, the clanking of razor clams from a McQueen's famous dress, razor clam dress. And all of these, we actually recorded them in an anechoic chamber, which is a room that doesn't have any echoes or electromagnetic waves. So you're hearing it in its purest form. So the taffet, for example, it actually sounds like white noise. It doesn't sound like what you imagine taffet to sound like because it's in this new environment. So that's an example of some of the sounds. And then in terms of smell, we work with this incredible artist called Cecil Tollis, who has this device that is able to capture the smell molecules of dresses, garments, and accessories, which have thousands of smell molecules. And she's able to capture them and replicate them. So you can actually smell the olfactory history of garments and accessories from our collection. And sometimes they capture the scent of the woman who wore it, the scent that she wore, sometimes the environment she lived in, what her eating habits were. I always get concerned, but we do a whole gallery around Millicent Rogers. Millicent Rogers donated a vast majority of her wardrobe to the Brooklyn Museum collection, which was transferred to us in 2009. And we have a whole section that I think we did something like 27 garments and accessories that we did smell molecules of. And the idea is that you could actually capture the smell of Millicent Rogers. So this poor woman who donated her garments to the museum had no idea that eventually we'd be capturing her smell molecules. But it's been a really popular part of the exhibition. And then we end, in terms of touch, you can feel the form and floral decoration of a Minimist Dior, the Minimist Dior dress, which we created through an enhanced 3D printed facsimile. And we also did an embossed wallpaper of a 17th century waistcoat. So you can actually touch the walls and feel the embroidery of this. And it's to the specifications of Braille. And so that's a couple of examples of the touching. And then we end with artificial intelligence, which I know is very controversial. But what we wanted to do was to transform a passive and silent object into an active and voluble subject and to engage visitors in this dynamic exchange. So it's actually a wedding ensemble that was designed by Carlo Cerf for someone called Natalie Potter. And you can ask her any questions about her life, how she felt on her wedding day, who designed the dress, what it's made out of. So the idea behind it, we did months and months of research specifically about her dress, and so that you could actually ask as many questions as possible. And it evolves during the exhibition. So if there's a question we don't really answer, or we don't know the answer to, we can do research and add that to this custom version of ChatGPT.
Oh, that's amazing. And just a personal side note, Cicely and I have known each other for almost 20 years. So I was so excited that her work was in the exhibition before I became a fashion historian. I was a contemporary art gallerist, and Cicely and I worked on two different projects back in the early 2000s together that involved her scent work. Her work is super fascinating.
Extraordinary. She's so poetic. I think that's, for me, the exhibition tries to marry the poetics of fashion with the science of fashion. And I think Cecil's a prime example of somebody who's able to sort of get behind the science of, in this particular case, garments and accessories, but with this incredible poetry. We also work with Nick Knight in the exhibition, and he's produced a lot of the projections. And the idea behind them is to reveal these high-definition details of these weave structures and applied embellishments that are really invisible to the naked eye. And I think when it came to seeing, obviously, the Met is a visual arts museum. And it was important for us that when information is about garments, it's being communicated solely through sight, that it was important for us that it be presented, with optimizing viewing and also with this visual appeal that makes you think differently about the object and that the naked eye can't see. So that was really the concept behind a lot of the close-up, was to heighten our observational awareness, but also to enhance our visual appreciation and understanding of those particular garments.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that Worth dress that's set in motion is making the rounds time and time again across social medias, because it's just so amazing to see these, as you said, dormant, now dormant objects that are never going to be worn again on a human body. To see them in motion is really, really special. And in so many ways, technology is a supporting actor in this exhibition. Some applications of it are visual, as such as the case of Pepper's Ghost. Would you tell us about what Pepper's Ghost is and why this was used in the show?
Yeah, Pepper's Ghost, it's actually an illusion technique that was used in theater, particularly in the 19th century, in which an image of an object out of view is projected onto a mirror So it appears as if it's in front of the visitor, but it creates this very spectral feeling to it and a sort of three-dimensional spectral feeling to it. And it's what, you know, we were saying earlier, that a lot of the, because of the fragility of our Sleeping Beauties, precludes them from being dressed on a mannequin. So they're displayed flat in the exhibition in glass cases, that they're the Sleeping Beauties. And technique does very much deny the viewer the truest expression of the costumes, which obviously needs the dimension of a body to realize its original functions and to achieve its original and intended appearances. So we're resurrecting those garments rather than reawakening them. So we're like very Lazarus. Yeah, every Sleeping Beauty was going to have a Pepper's Ghost, but it was so time consuming. So we only decided to resurrect the Worth dress I mentioned earlier, the one that's suffering from the warp loss, the cloud dress from 1887. And it was so complicated. It probably took just over 6 months to achieve, because originally it had to undergo digital scanning, and it had to then photography, and then construction analysis and pattern making. And I think Elizabeth will talk about this in more detail, because she really was the person who worked very closely with Nick's team to resurrect this particular garment. But all of that content that we received was then tried to manipulate into an avatar, a digital avatar. And that was really intended to like approximate the original wearer, who was somebody called Carrie Astor, who was the daughter of the Mrs. Astor from the famous 400 Ballroom Club. So achieving the correct silhouette and then the correct materiality, that's what took months and months and months of refining, which Elizabeth did with Nick's team. And she also did incredible work on the color. So she measured the original color with a spectrometer, then converted it into the nearest Pantone hue. So when you see the garment, it's the original colorway. When you see the original garment, it's very much, the colorway is not as vibrant as it was originally. The gown was designed to be worn at a ball. So we wanted the Pepper's Ghost to dance. So then the movements, we actually recorded the movements of a professional dancer, which were motion captured and then applied to the avatar. So the whole process took forever to do. the reason why we only did one at the end of the day.
Well, there is also another, maybe it's not Pepper's Ghost, but there's another motion animation of a woman walking in a hobble skirt, which I found incredibly charming.
You're right. And that was easier because we were able to recreate that garment. So we recreated it and then put it on a model and film it. So that was much easier than having to put all these composites together and patterns. That was such an easy one to do. And then we found these incredible early footage around 1912 of women at the Longchamp races wearing the hobble dress. So the model walked in the same way that somebody would have done in the early 20th century. So yeah, you're right. There's two Pepper's Ghosts. Yeah. That was easier one to do there.
Yeah. Cassidy and I are in love with that particular time period of the 19 teens. And we've actually written a book about fashion and the art of pochoir. So that little Pepper's Ghost, it was paired with it with one of Sem's pochoir publications. So that really hit home for me. So some of these other applications of technology go somewhat unseen as they took place prior to the show being mounted. And this is the case with some of the dye analysis that went into the garments in this beautiful, high lofted room that's entirely filled with not only gorgeous, like a gorgeous hat garden, but all of the garments in the vitrines are yellow. And the date range of these garments spans about 250 years. So were there any surprising finds that came to light in some of these other rounds of scientific testing that were done before the show was mounted?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the dye analysis probably was one of the areas of focus that produced the most surprising results. And as you know, yellow is such a divisive color in fashion. It's in the center of the spectrum. And so one part, it could be this orange red, or on the other part, it could be this green brown. So it has this reputation of indeterminacy. And as you said, there's 14 garments actually that date, as you say, for about 250 years. And by working with our scientific researchers in the museum, the chemical structure of each dye is determined through the spectrum of visible light that absorbs and reflects. And those are presented as graphs. But I think what was the most surprising, there was two surprises, I think. One was the fact that there's an 18th century dress, but I think it's about 1770s, that through the dye analysis we found was actually Chinese export silk. And we'd always cataloged it as European. So the dye that was used was a Chinese dye. Looked into the selvage, and it was clear then that it was produced in China, and also the yardage and the width of the yardage also verified that. And the other surprise was Fortuny. I've always felt, and the mythology of Fortuny is that he's always used natural dyes. for his work or their work. And we found out it was actually artificial. So we sort of exposed.
Oh, that's interesting.
that was a surprise. But you're right. The dye analyses, I think, reveal the most interesting finds, I think, or the most surprising finds.
Yeah. And in the exhibition catalog, listeners, there is a whole section. If you're interested in this aspect at all, there's a whole section in the back that tells all the stories of all the objects that had their dye analysis run on them. It's just quite interesting.
Our listeners will know about this. We have a very big sustainability platform on the podcast. And we were very pleased to see so many of the garments and ensembles featured in the exhibition in various ways engaging with sustainable design. So, for instance, you have the section on sequins and their material history. That was really great and speaks to how many materials we are all familiar with are getting new sustainable lives via technological innovations. Are there a couple of pieces in particular you might like to mention that speak to that aspect as well?
Yeah, I think that by having this thematic through line about nature, it allowed us to expand our collection of designers, as you said, employing ethically sustainable practices. And the examples range from examples like Ronald van der Kemp and Hilary Taymor, who both created pieces made out of dead stock fabric. We also have an example by Phoebe English and also Paolo Casana, and they're working much more with natural dyes. They're both in the yellow section, which includes traditionally the color yellow was produced by the plant well, which has a yellow flower. And that's what they use in those two pieces. We also have some work by Richard Malone, and he's created two ensembles actually, created from a fabric that's made out of a regenerated nylon yarn made from waste, plastic, mainly plastic waste from the sea, like found fishing lines and plastic bottles. And then we also have some examples by a company called Botta, an aquatic fashion line. And the garments are made out of, at least in part, from seaweed, a mix actually of cellulose and seaweed. And the ones you mentioned earlier, which were the sequins. And we have two examples, one by Stella McCartney, who, as you know, has promoted sustainability really from the beginning of her career. And she worked with a designer called Alyssa Brunata, and she created these bio-sequins made out of cellulose. And then Philip Lim worked with a product designer called Charlotte McCurdy, and he created bioplastic sequins created from algae. So there's quite a range of garments. And I think we deliberately wanted to integrate them throughout the exhibition rather than separate them into their own sub-theme, really to highlight the sort of the compatibility of sustainable pieces with other fashions. And also the prevalence of sustainability now. We're no longer seeing ethical practices as a novelty. And I wanted to show that it's become the norm and it's really essential for the survival of both our industry and the environment.
Yes, absolutely. We talk about it almost every episode of the show in one facet or another. But we simply cannot talk about sequins without mentioning perhaps my favorite piece in the exhibition, and that is the Yves Saint Laurent Iris's jacket from his Haute Couture 1988 collection, which, as you note, is a, quote, simulacrum of Van Gogh's 1889 painting, Irises. We're hoping that you could tell us a little bit about this piece, because in the exhibition catalog, you write, Maison Lesage executed the embroidery. This artistic and technical tour de force involved 600 hours of handwork, required 250 meters of ribbon, 200,000 seed and bugle beads, and 250,000 paillettes in 22 different colors. 9 female artisans completed the design and worked on it in sections. I mean, this piece is really one of those moments of fashion history where fashion truly transcends genres and actually becomes a little wearable piece of art. And so I love this art history reference in terms of fashion. And also, it's rather surprising pairing with a Margiela piece that it sets in conversation with. So we would love to know more about both of these pieces.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I never remember the hours of handwork and the ribbons and the sequence. I'm glad the exact numbers, I always forget it. Yeah, no, as you say, it's a real tour de force of the technical mastery of the work of Maison Lesage. And as you say, it was created for his spring-summer 1988 Haute Couture collection. I think what's interesting about it is that in terms of the, as well as the technical superb expertise of it, it also echoes the sort of composition of the original version too. There's that very cropped composition where Van Gogh zoomed in on the irises. And that's what Saint Laurent did, was zoom in even further in a way to try and capture the luminosity of Van Gogh's colors. And he would turn a lot of the handwork, the ribbon, the beads, the paillettes Part of that was also to enhance the sort of materiality of Van Gogh's really thick, very wavy brushstrokes. So you get a sense of that. And we worked with Nick again to create an animation. So it's when you walk into space, it's as if you're walking into and being immersed in the embroidery. And what's extraordinary is that that actual video took 4 months to create. And I think it wasn't so long. I thought it's just a video, but every bead and every paillette had to be scanned in separately by CGI. So in a way, the actual animation is a tour de force of haute couture in and of itself, or digital haute couture in and of itself, because we wanted to capture this, the depth and the three-dimensionality of the original. And we could only do that through CGI. So in a way, that in itself reflected the time taken to create the actual jacket. And as you say, we pair it with, and it's actually an interpretation of Saint Laurent's jacket. So it's removed from Van Gogh. So it's actually, where Saint Laurent was looking at Van Gogh, Margiela was looking at Saint Laurent. So it's a nice sort of, I suppose, menage a trois, as opposed to a tete-a-tete. And it reflects the Martin's deconstructionism. And it appears as almost like a collage or a patchwork. And I think in the catalogue, we call it like an exquisite corpse formed from the detritus of the couture atelier, which is exactly what it is. So it's not sewn seamlessly together, which to create this unified canvas, which is what Saint Laurent did. It's much more deconstructed. But again, it's another example of a designer reawakening costumes in our collection through interpretation.
Yeah. I mean, in those aspects of deconstruction and quote-unquote decay, it's very Margiela, but at the same time, it might be one of the most exuberant examples of his work.
Yeah.
And really, as the Yves Saint Laurent jacket speaks to, but so many pieces in this exhibition, is really such a treat for fashion historians and fashion history lovers, because so many of the objects on view we have seen in books, we have read about, but never actually had the pleasure of seeing in person. So I have a couple questions lumped into one, but I'm curious if you ever have pinch me moments working with one of the most important fashion collections in the world, and maybe this exhibition was a way for you to share some of your favorite fashion history moments with us. But are there any pieces in the exhibition that are super important that you'd like to highlight, or your personal favorites, if that is even possible to choose?
I'm going to try and fold those questions into one answer. I think one of the rooms that I really enjoy, we've called it the Spectre of the Rose. And it's a room, again, working with Cecil, that uncovers the sort of ghostly remains of particular dresses, but the dresses that were all directly connected to scent and to perfume. One is, the one in the center is a dress by Paul Poiret. It was called the Rose de Ribes dress, and it's worn by his wife, who was also his muse, Denise. And it carries a pattern of, I suppose, the calligraphic roses that are very much similar to the Paul de Ribes rose that was part of Poiret's label. And when you look at the actual garment, it has these stains on it that we think are the result of Denise wearing his first scent, which is called La Rose de Rosine. And we think that just because there's a photograph of her wearing it in New York, in America, one of Poiret's first trips to America, where he was also launching or promoting La Rose de Rosine. So it's likely that she doused herself in Rose de Rosine in a way as part of his commercial and promotory aspects of this scent. And when Cecil did the smell molecules, it does indeed have a very rose smell to it. So we believe that was it. And there's two other garments in there that are also connected to scent that we discovered when we began working on the exhibition. One is an ensemble by the House of Dracol. And we found in the chest of the dress, it's actually it's a leather sealed envelope. And it's got the name of a d'Orsay perfume called La Rose d'Orsay. And it's likely that garment was also used to promote that particular scent, and the wearer was using it as part of the actual garment itself. And the other one is another, not by the House of Dracol, but by Christophe Dracol. And it has a much more modest connection to scent, where, again, in the chest, it's actually almost like a little sachet that contains remnants of dried flowers and aromatic powder. So it's more customized. So we have three very different representations of using clothing as a way of a vehicle, I suppose, for promoting scent, either commercially or more individually. And then Cecil replicated these smell molecules. And then
Amazing.
Translated it onto a wall. So it's a scented wall that you can actually rub and smell the smell molecules. So I think that's probably one of my favorite rooms, I think. And I think for the fashion nerds, I think they'll enjoy that, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah, April texted me immediately when she was there and said, you can smell the Poiret Arib dress, by the way. Which is just so fascinating. I mean, these are those human elements that you just don't ever get to experience in a fashion exhibition, and that aren't usually highlighted, right? It's highlighting the most pristine examples of fashion history, but the fact that you're highlighting these human, very human elements that we all relate to, I think, is really building into one of the successes of this exhibition, and which mm-hmm. make it so unique and special.
Yeah. And definitely the Poiret Arib rose dress was one of my highlights as well. And fun fact, when Cass and I were working on the Fashion and Post-War book, Poiret Arib is, of course, a seminal figure in that period of fashion illustration. And prior to becoming known for fashion illustration, he had been working as an illustrator of satire quite a bit. And he was working for all of these satirical Parisian fashion publications. And some of his work was rather bawdy, let's just say. And as I was delving into his past work, one of the things that I realized in some of his, let's say, rather sexy illustrations, he almost always uses that, what we now know as the Poiret Arib rose, to cover women's genitalia. And this predates him using it for Poiret's logo. So I cannot get this out of my mind now. Every single time I see the Poiret rose, I'm like, oh.
Thank you. That's what I think about now, too.
I'll send you some of his old work. So, Andrew, thank you so much for being here. We have one last question for you today. What do you hope that people ultimately take away from this show?
Yeah, I think that part of the show is to enhance this more personal, this more intimate connection to objects in our collection. But I suppose the more lofty ambition would be to sort of expand the traditional study of costume, which is normally based on the artistic and the academic, I suppose, the artistic and the aesthetic and historical, to the more sensorial and the emotional. I suppose that's probably the ultimate ambition. And also to extend the usually visual readings of fashion within museums to more multisensory and non-visual interpretations. And I think one of the aims of the exhibition was to facilitate more accessibility, full-bodied experiences for differently abled visitors. And I think that's something that, oddly enough, a lot of the reviews haven't really picked up on, is the fact that a lot of these interventions and a lot of these experiments is really to give more access to differently able visitors of the museum. And that was very much one of our intentions behind, particularly the touch and feel galleries. We worked very close with our education department. As I mentioned, we had that one wall that has, it's embedded or embossed, should I say, with the embroidery of a Jacobean waistcoat. And again, it was very much specifically to the specifications of Braille, which is 0.4 millimeters. So people who are partially sighted or blind can feel the embroidery of that particular piece. So that's also, I suppose, one of the sort of broader ambitions of the exhibition too, yeah.
And again, well, I need to go back for a third time. These are some of the little points, finer points that I had missed, gawking at all the amazing things that are on display that I had never seen before.
Oh, thank you.
I also hope that this will set a standard for a new type of exhibition experience that we will see more of across institutions in the future. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really, truly a treat for both of us.
Yes, thank you so much.
A massive thank you to Andrew Bolton for joining us for the first time on Dressed. And of course, we are actually not done yet. On Friday, we are going to be joined by members of both the Costume Institute's collections and conservations teams to learn more about their roles at the CI and also about their contributions to this exhibition specifically, which by its very premise highlights their usually behind-the-scenes professions. On view now through September 2nd, 2024, you still have time to make it in person to see this exhibition. I will be heading there soon, and we promise you this is one you do not want to sleep on.
Yes, and we have not mentioned yet that there is a exquisite exhibition catalog if you cannot make it to New York City before the beginning of this fall. So you can get your hands on that too. It's in a slipcase. So many gorgeous images. I think that does it for us today, Dress listeners. May you consider reawakening some of those pieces in your closet next time you get dressed. We will, of course, be featuring many of these pieces on our Instagram this week. And you can find content related to these two episodes by heading over to @dressed_podcast on Instagram and using the hashtags dressed497 and #dressed498. You can also DM us on Instagram @dress_podcast if you wish, or alternately, you can email us by writing to us at hello@dressedhistory.com.
And dressedhistory.com is also where you can check out our latest offerings from the Dressed universe. So we, of course, have Dressed, the School of Fashion, and I have my current course, What Women Wore to the Revolution, where we are covering some of the most iconic eras in fashion history, the 1930s through the 1960s. And you did miss the first class, but not to worry. If you want to sign up, you can still do so, and I'll send you a recording of that first class. And then I also, on July 28th, am doing a one-time live lecture because you all know how much I love the Olympics. So if you want to come along and explore over 2,700 years of the relationship between fashion and dress and the Olympics, please join me on July 28th. And speaking of offerings, dress listeners, August 11th, we do hope that you will join us online and celebrating our 500th episode of Dress.
What? That's right. Dress turns 500.
Yes, absolutely. I cannot believe it. I know you can't either, April, and we are so excited that we want to celebrate this with you. So we are actually doing a live podcast recording of that episode on August 11th. You just have to head on over to dressedhistory.com to register and join us for what is sure to be a very, very fun evening.
Yes. And if speaking of fun evenings, if you would like to join me at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City for my Fashion History Fridays, those are 90-minute tours of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces, starting in the ancient world and fast-forwarding all the way into the 20th century. Dress listeners, thank you as always for tuning in, and more Dressed coming your way on Friday. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.